So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Is there anybody who is this their first time? Usually have a formal talk first, but there'll be time for questions and answers toward the end. Actually, today I want to talk about the teaching on non-self. You know, over these past few months, we've been looking at some of the most fundamental teachings of the Buddha. And we've had many talks, discussions, intensives on impermanence, the law of cause and effect, the defects of samsara, which means, quite simply, why it is, no matter how much we try, the worldly life cannot really give us the kind of peace and meaning and happiness that our hearts truly seek. We've looked at how precious this life is and the wonderful opportunities and freedoms that we have and the importance of using this life in a meaningful way, purposeful way, not to waste it. And then more recently, we've looked at the five hindrances, those mind states that obscure purpose and meaning and clarity and take us on all kinds of journeys, all of which end, are characterized by dissatisfaction. Whether these be journeys of attachment, of grasping, desiring, needing, wanting, whether these be journeys of ill will, aversion, avoidance, anger, whether these be journeys of doubt, whether these be journeys of kind of low sinking down mood, laziness, torpor, sloth, heaviness, depression even perhaps, and the other opposite, which is a restless mind, excitable mind, the mind that can never settle down, that always needs stimulation. All these five hindrances and their variations, again, obscure the basic clarity and ease of mind and really prevent us from following through on the aspirations of our heart. Before I, just parenthetically, I want to talk about non-self, which is in the three marks of existence, which we haven't gone into yet. But I just want to say parenthetically, I had a conversation with somebody yesterday and somehow talking about life, and this person was saying that they've come to realize that it's life's really about the simple pleasures. How does that sound to you? That sound right? Life's about the simple pleasures. Actually, when this person said it, I stopped and I thought, no, it's not. Because if life's about the simple pleasures, what about the things that aren't pleasurable? If life's about the simple pleasures, what about the things that are the opposite of pleasure, which are painful? Are they not part of life? Right? If life is simply about achieving endless pleasures, then we kind of are caught, aren't we? We're caught. In the Buddhist teaching, they're called the eight worldly winds, and one of the worldly winds that drives the world is the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, like the pursuit of fame and the avoidance of being anonymous, not being noticed, the pursuit of success and the fear of failure, things like that. These are the things that drive us. These are the things which motivate us. We're motivated to get things and we're motivated not to get other things. And that keeps us very busy, very, very busy and stressed out. But Buddhism does not say the purpose of life is simple pleasures. The purpose of life is to live life openly with great presence and to live a life of equanimity, which means, sometimes things are pleasurable, sometimes things are unpleasurable. Right? Can the mind be even and open to both? Because both are part of life. Once we set up a duality between this and that, and we make a choice, I want this, I don't want that, can you see we're caught? Because we're always happy when we get that, but of course the only way we get that is by really going after that, and the way we really hold on to that is by making sure it lasts, and at the same time making sure that those things that are unpleasurable don't come in, and once again we're what? Very busy. How much easier just to be open, right? When things are pleasurable, fine. When things are unpleasurable, fine. Actually, there's a saying in Zen, every day is a good day when nothing hangs in the mind. Interesting, right? Right? Some people say every day is a good day, things go better with Coke. Right? Every day is a good day when you've had your Coke. That's Coca-Cola, that is. Right? The messages of the world and advertising are telling us that we need, we need things to be happy. And when we get those things, then we'll be happy. That's a good day, right? Good day. Everybody's feeling, how was your day? Oh, it's a good day. Why do people say it's a good day? Because it went my way. Right? Isn't that the truth? It went my way. Right? How was your day today? Not a good day. Why? And what do people mean when they say that? Well, things didn't go the way I wanted them to. Can you see how you're caught between good days and bad days? We have to understand that this Dharma comes at things at a 180 from the way we ordinarily see things. Every day is a good day when nothing hangs in the mind. Isn't that wonderful? So, good day and bad day is not about what's happening out here. That's what we usually think, right? Good day or bad day is about what's happening in here. Every day is a good day when nothing hangs in the mind. If we want good days, we want a mind that is open and free and accepting. That has equanimity in it, is balanced, can move with the good, can move with the so-called bad. Even to say good and bad is to divide up the world and experience in ways that are not inherent to it. It's our own judgment. So anyhow, that's all I want to say on that. Does anybody disagree with that, by the way? Please, somebody may. Anybody want to stand up for the simple pleasures in life? So in the in some of these basic early Buddhist teachings, like the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and these fundamental teachings on impermanence and cause and effect, and the defects of this worldly life. Again, please understand, when we say defects of worldly life, we live the worldly life. we are people of the world. So it's not negative in that sense. It just says, use the things of the world wisely, intelligently, so you don't get caught, so you don't get hooked, right? See the inherent defects, the incapacity of things to give us happiness, other than a momentary happiness that comes from getting it. And whether that getting it's a thing or an experience or a person or a job or whatever, relationship, it's all the same. The happiness is in the getting. But a deeper happiness is a happiness that comes in from a mind that is happy. And is not dependent on things and the externals, the ups and downs of externalities, to give us happiness. That's the defect of worldly life. It cannot deliver what it promises. Coke does does not make life better. Things don't go better with Coke. So the third characteristic or mark of phenomena, and in the Buddhist teaching, when they talk about the characteristics of phenomena, they're talking about the characteristics of everything. The characteristics of animate things, inanimate things, physical things, as well as mental things. So beside these fundamental teachings on impermanence, everything changes, nothing stays the same, on the defects of samsara and the suffering that comes from grasping, the third profound teaching of the Buddha, which I think is harder for us as Westerners to grasp and have most difficulty is the teaching of non-self, of insubstantiability. So let me spend a few minutes. I mean, this is a profound subject, but I did want to talk about it because in our understanding and what we're looking at over these months is, you know, what's really going on in life? Is it as it appears? And of course, one of the things we've learned is even though it appears in the moment to be permanent, like we all look permanent, right? This whole building looks permanent, we look permanent. Our thoughts when they arise and we're caught in them, we think they're permanent. We think situations are permanent. So one of the things we've learned, of course, is that's not the case. Things are changing all the time. We're changing all the time, right? None of us are the same. None of us are the same person who walked in here today. None of us are having the same thoughts, the same feelings, the same sensations. I mean, everything is changing. Constantly. And that's going on everywhere, in the inside, outside, mentally, physically. That is just the nature of this endless change. How is it changing? According to causes and conditions. What happens when you grasp at it? You will not get pleasure, okay? Or happiness. Now, the third characteristic of phenomena is this, its insubstantiability. Basically, that means is that things are just made up of parts. Things are just composite of things. And there is no permanent thing there. And that really blows us away. Because we look around and we say, oh, there's Brian, there's Emmett, there's Salima, right? They look like a thing to me. That looks like Brian to me, doesn't it? I mean, that looks like a fan to me. This looks like a table to me. This looks like a flower, right? Isn't that what we think? These are, that's a flower. That's a Brian, that's a fan, that's a table. Wouldn't we agree? Isn't that how it appears? And the Buddha says, no. I know that's how it appears to you and how the mind labels things, but that is not really the way it is. And this is not a metaphysical principle. This is not an esoteric, spiritual, mystical principle. This is a principle of reality. This is something that, if it is true, is known to science. And it is known to anybody who wants to investigate. Right? So we call this a table, right? Would everybody agree we call this a table? But is there something intrinsic here that's a table? Okay, just follow along with me, right? So we'd say this is a table. Now, if I took these things off, right, these supports, and if I took the front off, and I took this apart, and I laid it all out, right, we would see what? Parts, wooden parts. Well, what happened to the table? That thing we call the table. What happened to it? Well, it changed because it never was a table. It was just a composite of parts. Right? And we label it in our, using the word in our language, we call it a table. But we think that there's really something here called a table rather than just a bunch of parts put together that have a function in time and space, right? Same thing with a fan, same thing with a flower. Right? We would call this a, anybody in the English language, we call this what? A flower. Yeah. And we think what? That there's really some thing called a flower here. But it's not true, is it? Because if you took off each of the petals, and if you took off the stamens, and you took off the leaves, and you laid them all out, what would you have? What? Parts. What? Yeah. Or if somebody was cleaning up, they'd have trash. They would call it trash, right? Or energy. I mean, but all. But again, a minute ago it was called the flower, and now it's called trash. What somebody cleaned? What somebody forgot to clean up in here? So things appear solid, but upon a simple investigation, we see what? They're not. And because they are not solid, but made up of parts, because those parts have come together just because of causes and conditions, would you know what I'm saying? They were, I mean, this grew, was connected to something, was in the earth, seeds, bulbs, grew, cut, brought here, made of parts, impermanent, therefore will what? Come back here in a few days, how will it look? Not very pretty, right? Because it is empty of anything solid, because it is produced by endless causes and conditions, it is impermanent. That's just the way it is. Now, when we understand this, we do not grasp at this at all, because we know that grasping of it, wanting it to stay permanent, will only lead to what? Suffering, unhappiness. Because as it begins to wilt, we will get sad, won't we? We understand that this is impermanent. Why is it impermanent? Because it's just made of parts. What are those parts coming together? They're coming together according to causes and conditions. When those causes and conditions change, it will change. Right? Is that clear? Same way for this table, right? Take it apart, no longer do we have a table. We could put it together and make it into a little bench, right? Then we call it what? A bench. Oh, I thought it was a table, right? You see? If I use it like this, it's a table. If I was up here sitting on it, you'd say, you'd call it a bench. See, you might get confused, but what is it? Is it a bench or a table? But that's only if you're caught up in words. Otherwise, you'd see it's just this. But this, like all phenomena, is subject to impermanence, right? Because it's just made up of parts. Are you with me so far? Okay, now let's get to the hard one. This. So we say, right, that this is special. Because this has something inside it called a what? What? Called a self. And that this belongs to something called a self, right? Isn't that what we say? Right? This body belongs to it. This thing called self, Fred or ego, whatever you want to call it. This I, this me, right? It has a body. It has possessions. It has thoughts, feelings, right? It has dreams. It has a past. It has a future. Isn't that true? Is there anybody here who disagrees with that? So we think there is something here called Fred. The same way we think there's something here called a table, right? But when we took the table apart, we found there was no such thing called a table, just parts, right? When we took the flower apart, we found out there was no such intrinsic thing called a flower. It was just a bunch of parts. When you take them together, right? So what happens when you take this apart, right? say, oh, this is Fred. But if we took him apart, if we laid him all out here with all his parts, would you find something called Fred? I mean, even a trace of anything called Fred? No. Well, that's interesting. Right? No, if Fred's not to be found in the body, right? Is that right? I mean, I want you to help me. Is Fred in the body? We've just laid him out, can't find a trace of him. I mean, is he hiding in one of the parts? Hiding, maybe he's, people say, oh, it's in my heart. Well, take your heart apart. You know, get that little heart, let's just take it apart. Are we going to find it? No. Well, if you say something exists and you can't find it, what does that tell you? It doesn't exist, and our belief that it exists is irrational, right? Now, if we can't find a trace of Fred, of the ego self I in the body, where else might it be hiding? In our mind. What's your name?
Allison.
Allison, very good. In our mind, right? I mean, pretty much we'd all agree we are body-mind, right? So if Fred is not in the body, we just checked it out, he's not there, then he must be in the mind, right? This is simple. This is like simple deduction. This is just detective work, basic stuff. So when you take your mind apart, let's just take your mind apart. What do you have in your mind? Thoughts. Anything else you have in your mind? What?
Feelings.
Okay. Thoughts, feelings, anything else you have in your mind? What? Perceptions, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, beliefs, memories, imagination, right? In any of that, if you took that all apart, is there something? Because don't forget, Fred says what? Fred says, my body, this is my body, right? And Fred says what? These are my thoughts. Right? Isn't that the way we talk? You know, let me tell you what I'm thinking. Right? Let me tell you what I'm thinking. Let me tell you what I'm feeling. As if there is an I separate from the thoughts and the feelings that are having these things. Isn't that the way we talk? So this I, this self, has to exist somewhere if it's real. Right? I mean, is that true? I'm just talking reality here. Right? If we say something exists, it has to exist somewhere. Right? If I see, what we call this a watch, right? So if I said, there's a watch in this room, right? You'd do what? You'd look for it. And if there really is a watch in the room, somebody would go, oh, I found it, right? And then we would say, yeah, that's right, there is a watch in the room, even though it's well hidden. Okay? So this self, it says my body, so we know it's therefore not in the body, and we look for it in the body, couldn't find it, so it must exist outside in the body. Then we look for it in the mind, and we find thoughts, feelings, perceptions, emotions, memories, all kinds of things. But have you found an entity called a self in there? I mean, just spend a moment just looking into your minds. Do you see something that in any way resembles a self? You know, maybe like a little you about that big or something. Pulling all the strings. Has anybody come across anything that looks anything like a self, an ego? Well, but you've never been told, but yet we say, myself, right? My thoughts, my feelings, my body, my perception, my past, my future, my dreams, my hopes, right? My likes, my dislikes, my needs, my wants. I mean, isn't this the way we all talk? Yeah, this is the way we all talk. Good. I want to make sure I'm not the only one. So that's why we talk. We talk this way to each other. But the Buddha stopped and looked inside his own body mind to see, is there really something there? I mean, just because everybody believed the earth was flat, did that mean it was actually flat? No. It was a rational belief. I mean, at a certain time in life, we believed there was a Santa Claus. That the moon is made of cheese. Right? That cows jump over the moon. But we know now that's not quite the way it is. So this is a big one. So this self, this ego, this me, this mine, this I, if it exists, it has to exist in some form, right? Either physically or mentally. Has anybody found it? This self that owns everything, that has, as Salima says, all these complexes, right? It has a complex that it's better than everybody else. Has a complex that it's worse than everybody else. Has a complex that it's equal to everybody else, right? What is the self that has all these things? But when the Buddha looked into it the way we are doing, but really looked into it deeply, he found nothing. Nothing meaning no thing. He found what? Parts. 2,600 years before science began to unravel the appearance, the supposed solidity of things. The Buddha and the meditators discovered this 2,600 years ago. They even talked about atoms. Little particles that they discovered in their meditation. They found parts within parts. Matter within matter. But they could never find a thing. A solid, permanent thing. Called a self, called a me, called a, you know. The same way, you can call it a table, but there's no real thing here called a table. You call it a flower, but there's no real thing here called a flower. It's just a convention. We give things names. So if I said, Brian, could you bring me the flower? You know, Brian wouldn't go get the vacuum cleaner. Right, so it's good. Language is helpful. Right? But even the vacuum cleaner. Is there really such a thing there as a vacuum cleaner? No. Take all the parts apart. You got lots of parts. Will that vacuum cleaner last forever? No. Subject to impermanence. If we really love our vacuum cleaner and want it always to stay the same, will it? No. Subject to impermanence. Somebody could steal it. Then what are we going to do? Suffer. Be unhappy. We loved that vacuum, didn't we? It was such a great vacuum. We hoped it would stay forever and work forever. And we are frustrated, disappointed, angry, sad when it doesn't. When somebody steals it. But our suffering, is it coming from the vacuum? No, it's coming from our misunderstanding of the way things are. So the Buddha said, how are things? The ordinary person, where they see permanence, the Buddha sees impermanence. Right? Where the ordinary person sees something as a source of happiness, the Buddha sees it as a source of suffering. And where the ordinary person sees something solid, the Buddha just sees something made up of parts, something that's in process. So this is a big one. Because we are so firmly wedded to our belief in ego and self. And our psychological systems, therapeutic systems, have been traditionally primarily built on what? Building up self, strengthening self. And our culture is all about what? Who's the most important person in the world? Me. Who am I supposed to look out for? Me. Take care of number one. Who's number one? Me. Right? A lot of messages that are always reinforcing the importance of ourself. But what if that self doesn't really exist in any permanent solid way? In a conventional way it does, right? I mean, if I said, hi Brian, who would answer back?
I could.
Hi, there you go. Right? So, I mean, there are conventional reasons, you know, to have names. I mean, legal reasons. You know, don't try to get out of your mortgage payment on this one, you know. So, Buddhism says conventionally there appears to be a self and it has a conventional purpose. But if you look deeply, if you look into it, you'll see there really isn't such a thing. Now, why is that important to people like us? This issue, I mean, is this just a philosophical, is this just kind of some kind of deep issue for deep thinkers? I'm just an ordinary person. I can't think that much. Too deep for me. Some people might say that. But this is not deep stuff. This is simple stuff. Why is it so important to get this one? Why did the Buddha put it out there?
Because we're going to suffer if we think that there's a self that isn't there. Kind
of yeah. Because self is the cause. Belief in the cause is the cause of 99.9% of our self-created suffering. Try to suffer without a self. Very difficult. I mean, where would all the drama in your life be if there wasn't a self in you or the other? Right? I mean, who is it that's disappointed? Who is it that's hurt? Who is it that's what? All of it. Who is it that's worried? What's going to happen to it? If it doesn't get this, if it gets this, what is that? It's not your body. Your body couldn't care less. What is it? Endlessly making demands. Endlessly ordering us around. Do this. Get that. Must have that. Get angry. Get pissed. Get worried. Get sad. Get disappointed, get hurt. Right? Endlessly it's giving us orders. And we what? Yes, sir. You name it, I'll do it. But what is it? You see, we never turn around to see who's barking the orders. Is there anything there? When you turn around and look, you may be surprised that there's really nothing there. Just a voice, a disembodied voice. So this teaching on non-self is key. That is why, non-self is such a fundamental teaching and practice within the Buddhist tradition. But please understand, it is not the way it is often presented in most religions or philosophical systems, where it's more of an ethical thing, a moral thing. In Buddhism, it's practiced, it is taught, because to live in the world of self is to live in the world of delusion. It's to misperceive how things really are. It's not just to be a bad person. Is that clear? It's not an ethical or philosophical or moral stance to be less selfish. To be selfish is to live in delusion because one's basing one's actions on something that doesn't inherently exist. It is an animal that demands to be fed. daily. From the moment you wake up to the time you go to bed, self is always telling you what? What? What to do and how you should be feeling. And self is just telling you what you need. What you need to do today to get yourself what? So self feels good. So self feels happy. So self feels safe. Right? Many people, that's what their life is about. To get their needs met so they'll be happy. To get their needs met so they'll feel safe. True? That's big issues for people. But what is this thing that doesn't feel safe? What is it? The self that doesn't feel safe. What? Yeah, just, yeah, well, it's worth looking into. You know, when we get angry, what is it that's getting angry? I'm not getting my way. Somebody's not doing what I want them to do. The situation is not unfolding the way I want. Right? You know what I'm talking about? We get angry. But what is this thing that's telling you what's going on? We would say what? Well, that's me. I'm angry. But that's not really the way it is it? Because when you look for this I, this self that's angry, you can't find it. Right? Remember, we take the whole body apart. What do we find? Can't find it. Hold on. This is confusing. I know there was somebody 5 minutes ago who was very pissed. Right? You remember him or her? Really pissed at what happened. Okay. Let me find this person, right? I look in my body, can't find him. I look in my mind, what do I find? Thoughts, feelings, perception. I can't find any trace of him. Well, that's interesting. He certainly felt real a while ago, didn't he? So strong, so pissed, so self-righteous, so right and they're so wrong. I'm so good, they're so bad, right? Isn't that how you feel? Yeah. Usually, right? Why can't everybody be like me? Right? Life would be so simple. What is this self? What is this thing that endlessly has issues? No self, no issues. Does this sound crazy when I'm speaking today? I mean, this is like just basic Buddhism. But it's for Westerners because we grow up in a culture that is so egocentric. We reinforce from childhood. You know, we want our little children to learn their names, right? And then begin to tell them about all the things that their names own. And it begins. The process of practice, of spiritual practice, meditative practice, is to touch into that non-self place, that place that we actually were born into. It is our heritage. We are all heirs to the world of non-self. As young children, we lived in that. Before we got a lot of language, before we were told, this is yours, this is not yours. These are your toys, these aren't your toys. These are Jimmy's toys. And then it just grew and grew and grew. And now we live, what? So many things we say are mine. And yet, none of it is substantial. None of it is solid. None of it is permanent. All of it we will have to leave at some point. And yet we base our whole life about holding on to these things. That is why this teaching is so important to get. To first get at least intellectually so we can soften, and eventually to get experientially. So it becomes our view, the way we view life. So again, what does this all mean? I'm interested in your response. Don't be shy. Yes.
Well, when you were speaking, and even like intellectually grasping it, a feeling does enter spaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about non-clinging self, it does seem like there's an intrinsic spaciousness that allows for other things to enter, such as like compassion. Or when I view my body dying or decomposing as parts, it just doesn't seem as relevant. It doesn't seem as frightening. It just seems spacious.
Mm-hmm.
It seems more free.
Yeah.
And less illusion is allowed to enter, less delusive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Molly, I'm just repeating this for the people who are watching in.
Okay.
Yeah, so Molly is sharing just when she contemplates this, there's a sense of spaciousness, openness that she feels in her mind. And even when she thinks about her body and its death and dying and decomposition, there's something spacious about that when there's no clinging or no identification.
Less fear.
Yeah, there's nothing to be afraid of. I mean, death is something that happens to what?
Everyone.
And it happens, it's a physical process. Right now, is your body scared of dying? Ask your body. And your body would say, what are you talking about? Our body has no problem with dying. It had no problem with being born. It had no problem with growing. And it has no problem with dying, right? It's natural. Decomposition. It's natural. Body is physical. So what is it that has a problem with the body dying? If the body doesn't, our minds. And again, you know, we can't even say our minds because our minds by themselves don't have a problem with it, do they? It's a sense of I. This figment of our imagination says what? I want to be here forever. Right? I want to be here forever, and I want everything that I want, that I like, to stay here with me. Right? Isn't that what the problem is? It's like a child, right? Throwing a temper tantrum. I don't want this to happen. The I doesn't want to die. Why doesn't it want to die? Because it knows it's not real. It's only real in its drama. It has no reality to it. It's just a thought. And since it is unreal and insubstantial, but it only lives through its identifications and its graspings and its clingings. It wants to hold on to all the things because it has no life without that, without its fabrication, that it is this and it has that. I have a body, right? Don't tell me I'm insubstantial. I have a body. I have possessions. I have a past. I have a future. Right? That's the story that self creates. But it's just a story, isn't it? Because past is what? Gone. Past doesn't exist. If we think about our past, we are what? We're telling ourselves a story about our past. The same way we tell ourselves a story about what we think our future is going to be. Those are just stories, fabrications of the mind. Again, it could be helpful. Memory can be helpful. If you go to your high school reunion, it's good to have a memory as somebody introduces themselves and wants you to remember them. It's good to remember them. There are reasons to hypothesize about the future. But those are just fabrications of our mind, right? They're just thoughts. They're not real, are they? Are our thoughts about the future real? Is that really the way it's going to unfold? No. Are our thoughts about the past real? No. Memory distorts. Memory picks and chooses. Right? Millions and billions of mind events, and the you know, the mind holds on to certain ones of them and puts it together in a certain way, right? You talk to one person about their childhood, they'll tell you one thing. You talk to their sister or brother who grew up in the same home, they'll tell you a totally different story. You go, what? Right? These people grew up in the same house and family, you know? I say, yeah. What does that tell you? Yeah. Yes, Andrew.
There seems to be awareness, and that awareness appears to be connected to this particular body, and it's aware of emotions, thoughts, feelings, etc. that seems to, well, I'll just stop with that, but that's different from the kind of self that we mistakenly impute to all this.
Right, so there is awareness. Right? Like right now, we are aware. This is really what's going on here, right? We're aware. And this awareness, uses the eyes to see, and the ears to hear, and the nose to smell, the tongue to taste, body to sense, right? And we are also aware of thoughts, feelings. We can. There's awareness of all that, yeah. But again, the same awareness, I mean, if I said to you, Andrew, are you aware of your big toe? Yeah. Okay. Are you aware that your head is nodding up and down? Good. Are you aware of me? Yeah. Are you aware of the Buddha? Oh, good. Are you aware of any sounds coming from Nebraska Avenue? So this awareness is not bound by anything, is it? I mean, it can be aware of your thoughts and your feelings, but you could look at somebody and be aware of how they're, you know, you can pick up on other people's feelings, can't you? If you saw somebody crying, you would be aware that they were what? Unhappy. So this awareness is not, just the property of this, is it? It goes out, comes in. It's pretty special, isn't it? Well, it is probably the most special thing about us. And yet we don't notice it, do we? Because we're too involved in what? Drama. We're too involved with drama to notice that which is aware of the drama. Yes. Up there in the peanut gallery.
Dora, who's participating via live stream, asks, so is self a thought?
Is self a thought? If you free your mind of I, me, mine, you will free yourself of self. Self is just a thought. It's just a fabrication of the mind. How do we know that? Because when we look into our body and mind, we cannot find anything else but that. We find the I thought, we find the me thought, we find the mind thought. It's just a thought. So when we have physical discomfort, what's having the physical discomfort? Our body. Who's having a problem with that? Self, me, mine. Right? I don't want to be feeling that. I don't want to be experiencing that. Right? That's where the problem is. The body's just having a sensation. It's okay with it. But there's something else that goes, shouldn't be happening to somebody like me. And that goes on all the time. So when I say, without the self, you will see. Now again, what I'm talking about is a deep meditative or philosophical transformation of the way one views things. But how does that manifest? It manifests in what? A more relaxed human being, a more at ease human being, a human being free of mostly all the emotional, negative emotional afflictions, right? It's all gone. So it's a big one.
I wonder about the energy system.
Yes.
I'm with you about the intellectual ideas, the self, the empties are not real, it's not true, it's the thought.
Yeah. In a self-existent true way. It doesn't mean it doesn't appear, it doesn't have the appearance of, and not a, right, it's saying something different. Yes.
There's this thing that is aware. Mind,
stop. There you go. You said there is a thing that is aware. Well, there you go. Yeah, it is. So what the introspection does, you know, with these key questions, it just calls into question the things that we just ordinarily think. Oh, yeah. Like we go, oh, well, then it's all awareness, right? Like that's a thing. Or it's all mind, like that's a thing. But when you look into it, you can't find anything. Right? Well, that's a deep question. That's the kind of question Buddhas ask themselves. Or I should say, that's the kind of questions that people who become Buddhas ask themselves. And when they understand that, they understand just exactly what the Buddha understood. Yes.
And I'm fascinated on the trend now of people taking selfies. I guess that sort of affirms that we have a picture with the president. But my question is, and you know this about me, but what is it that Thich Nhat Hanh says when you look in the mirror, you see your grandmother? And I've always had this, and I'm not saying it, I'm defending self-love. What he's talking about, and then in Touching the Earth, he talks about ancestors. What is that he's talking about? Because I look in the mirror and I do see my grandma.
Well, again, he's telling us a story. Oh, the question is when Thich Nhat Hanh talks about when you look in the mirror, you see your ancestors, right? Or when you touch the earth, you're touching your ancestors. Again, to be honest, everything that is elucidated by words is a fabrication of the mind. So, when you look in the mirror, in truth, what do you see? That. That's all you see. That's the truth. That. When I look in the mirror, I see that. Anything after seeing that is my own fabrication. Now again, it doesn't mean that we can't have thoughts that are ennobling, thoughts that are insightful. Right? Right. It's not saying that. So to say, I look in the mirror and I realize, you know, that I'm not looking at, you know, my face, I'm looking at my ancestor's face. This is his body. I didn't create this body. Right? This body came to me from my parents. Where did my parents? This is. So when I look in the mirror, all I'm seeing is a conglomeration of what? Of all my ancestral coming, right? In all causes and conditions. So that's a way of understanding that. But the truth is, that's understanding. But the truth is, when I look in the mirror, I see that. When I want to look into the causes and conditions of how that got here, then I understand, I can understand things. Now again, that type of thinking can open things up. Right, can break us out of this sense of, this is my body, and why, I want it, why doesn't it look the way I want? Right? A lot of people have problems with their body. They look in the mirror, they go, how did a guy like me get a face like that? I mean, that's not fair. I mean, I should be handsomer and younger, right? True. But that's crazy talk, isn't it? Isn't that crazy talk? That's a crazy talk. Because I never even chose my body. My body was a gift from my parents. It's a gift from my ancestors. It's a temporary habitation. Right? And having those kinds of thoughts gives us a sense of continuity, of just cause and conditions, that we are. I mean, again, we think we're with this, we think we're a self. But so many of the qualities we have, both positive and negatively, characteristics, thoughts, we've gotten from others. Right? I mean, if we had, if somehow, I don't know, in some science fiction universe, if we had been, if we had just sprung, on some desert island or something where nobody was around, and we had just, grown up or something, how would we be? With no language, right? Because the only reason we were speaking this way is somebody taught us language, right? No language. I mean, if you're all alone, you don't need language, do you? It's only when you have two or more that you need language. Right? So everything, which is again what Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, interdependence, and we are just a, everything we are is because of others. And when we know that, our arrogance goes away. Because we know all my characteristics, good and bad, many of them come from my ancestors, my family, nothing that I really had anything to do with, right? And through the endless experiences I've had in life and conversations and readings, that's all kind of, there are, hundreds of thousands of variables in each of us, right? And they're all, they're all unfolding still. We're in process. Last question, yes.
You seem to be caught up by our thoughts.
Okay. Shall we say, let me just say that for thee, that's an important. We seem to be caught up and hung up on our thoughts. Truer words were never spoken, Jeff.
So should we aspire to not think?
No. It's very tempting. And that's an important thing. It's sort of like saying, it's the sounds of the world that are the problem. They're driving me crazy. Let me just stop all the sounds of the world, right? Then my problem is solved, right? You see, the nature of this thinking mind. Now again, most of our thinking minds, because we grew up in such a thinking society, and because there is such endless stimulation these days, which, 2-3 generations ago, even for us, I'm not even talking about many people still in the world, but for us even, we are, 2, 3, 4 generations away from our ancestors who led much simpler lives, right? There was no electronics, there was no exposure to media. Most people live fairly simple, repetitive lives. Their minds were not as filled with thoughts as ours were. So, I mean, there were certain conditions I think, in our modern age, which are different than the past. But obviously, these teachings are 2,600 years old, so the basis is the same. Yeah. So this, and so it's a good one to end on. Yeah. So the problem, as you say, is thought, that we are caught up and hung up on thought. And so the answer is not to stop thought. The answer is to stop getting hung up on. You know, just to let them be. Learn to let them come and go. Right? And not to act always by what the thought is telling us. Because as many of us know, from painful experience, the things we hear in our mind may not be always the best advice. The interpretations our minds are giving us about what's going on and who did what and who's are often sources of suffering, aren't they? So we need to have mindfulness so we can be mindful of thoughts when they arise, right? Thoughts that are sticky, thoughts that are telling us what to do or what to feel, we need to be able to examine. Is it true? Right? Not only is it true from a logical point, but there's another question, which is, there is another person involved in this drama who also has thoughts, who think their thoughts are true. Does this sound like modern relationships? Right? Two people, their own thoughts, both thinking their thoughts are true, and not caring about what the other person is thinking, not respecting or giving credence to what the other, right? Can you see the problem? Yeah. So the capacity, you know, mindfulness is not just some kind of mystical meditative, it's necessary, right? So we can have some awareness of our thinking process, know that that's what's arising, have some distance so we can see them, and then be able to work with them in an intelligent, skillful way, before we act on them. You know, there needs to be that those intervening moments of clarity. Or what happens? Well, we know what happens. Right. Yeah. So again, this is important. The purpose of our practice is not to stop thought. That's very difficult and not necessary. The purpose of our practice is to be aware, right? And to be able to look deeply into. That's all. And that's not all that hard, especially if we have some understanding of what's going on. That's why we have these kinds of talks, you know what I mean? So we can get a different view of things. By the way, are thoughts real? No, they just come and go. Next time a thought arises, look directly right at it. You know what'll happen? It'll disappear, just like that. It cannot stand to be looked at. So we'll end here.